Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
I want a cheer. Yeah. All that I describe. Oh, you're gonna meet Bill. Everyone, street Bill. Love, love, or I thought I should have died. I'm not in the old kid room.
Here today on Radio Gorgeous Big Red Sofa, I'm very happy to introduce the granddaughter of Hilda Kemp, who was raised in the slums of southeast London. It's a story of bravery, self-reliance, love, and domestic violence. We're talking about We Ain't Got No Drink, Pa, a little girl's struggle to survive in the slums of 1920s southeast London. Catherine Kemp, author and granddaughter. Let's talk about your nan. Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Very well. So how did this come about if she is not on earth now, and how did you write it?
I'd always promised Nan that I would write her memoir. We always knew that she'd lived an extraordinary life because she talked about it, you know, from the minute that I can remember, you know, as a little girl all the way up until she died in 2003. She talked about all aspects of her life in great detail. And in fact, I remember when I was a teenager, sat at the dining room table saying, Nan, just shut up, will you? You know, you go on about the war so much. And I mean, now I really wish I'd done what we're doing today and I'd sat down and I'd recorded, you know, everything that she talked about, because obviously, you know, writing an oral history is it's been very much about sort of reconnecting with her sort of in spirit, if you like, and just desperately hoping that everything that I'm writing is absolutely you know, true to her.
Yeah, did you have any diaries? Did you have anything written down? Is it all from memory?
Well, as I say, she talked about her life in great detail throughout. So we knew, I mean, lots of the anecdotes and stories we kind of knew as gospel. And then when she was very seriously ill, she in 2002 and 2003, she was very, very much sort of saying, can you... I'd always said I'd write her memoir, and it became something that we talked about in much greater detail. And obviously I took notes at the time, but I mean, it is an oral history. And actually, as I was writing, I know this probably sounds a bit flaky, but I very much felt that I was reconnecting with her in that sort of different way, and that somehow she was kind of inhabiting my head and my heart again, which was rather an unnerving experience, but very pleasurable
she,
as well.
She really does have such a powerful story to tell. Mm. Now, what I want to know is she came from a poor family, but how poor were they?
They were
tell
desperate.
Us.
I mean, they were literally living hand to mouth each and every day. Her mother was one of 21 siblings born in two tiny, desperate slum rooms in the Grange in Bermondsey. My nan was the first of five siblings born to her mother, Emily, and her father, Ted Johnson. He was a casual docker, so he had to queue up every morning at the docks in order to get a day's work. And of course, they used to fight over work. It was a brutalising existence. He also earned extra pennies when he could as a bare knuckle fighter. So he would work at the Ring in Blackfriars, which is quite a notorious spot at the time for illegal fighting and illegal betting, because obviously gambling was forbidden then. So they never knew where, you know, each day whether they would eat. I mean, it was literally a case that, because also Ted Johnson used to drink heavily, you know, as many men did in those days, that they would work a back-breaking 18-hour day on the docks, literally lifting huge cargoes of you know, grains or spices or whatever it was off the great ships that were docked there. And then at the end of that, they would go and drink their money away. So he would come home with absolutely nothing, and Hilda's mother, Emily, would then have to somehow scrape together enough to eat, and sometimes there wasn't. It was literally, it was as difficult as that.
It really is traumatic. Now, I want to talk about him, because he was violent and very violent, and he beat up the mother regularly, your great-grandmother and your granny. Mm. I want to know what your feelings are towards him.
Well, they're mixed. He is my great-grandfather as well. So obviously I have that kind of blood connection with him. But But I grew up knowing that he was a bad man, that my grandmother's nose was broken so many times that, you know, that we always knew she had a broken nose because of his fists. So it's very hard to think kindly of a man like that. But the interesting thing about writing this memoir was that I had to look, obviously, into Ted's life and how he grew up. He was born in 1901. Mm. And at the age of six, he was sent begging by his father up into Blackfriars. And so, literally, he walked the 2 miles from Bermondsey up to Blackfriars to beg for the day. And if he came home with nothing, he would be beaten for his troubles. At home, he was the kind of skivvy. And my nan grew up hearing stories about his life as well, and how his stepmother poured boiling water on him as a form of punishment, how his father beat him. And you go, okay, well, you know, it's not right to kind of to take that behaviour and bring it into your own life, but you can see how it happened. If you're brutalised from the age of six, exactly, the sins of the fathers.
And there's no therapy and no domestic...
And no support, no, nothing.
RadioGorgeous.com.
So, and also a really interesting thing you said in the book was that women would walk around with bruises and black eyes and everything, and it was sort of socially acceptable, wasn't it?
I don't know whether it was socially acceptable, but it was a case of what went on behind closed doors stayed behind closed doors. The only way that you know, Nan was able to sort of explain it was that, you know, what went on between man and wife was seen as kind of sacrosanct, that even though people could hear it through the paper-thin tenement walls, people still kept to the side. And it wasn't to say that people weren't compassionate. This was a very close community. And people looked after each other in the sense that that Emily had shoulders to cry on, that people left anonymous packages of food on the doorstep because they knew that Ted was drinking the money away, that neighbours like Mrs. McIntosh were very kind to the children and kind to Hilda. And so they showed their support in those ways. But in terms of the actual violence, no one would step in. I mean, it's something that you'd think was inconceivable these days, but literally, as poor working class people, you know, what went on behind closed doors stayed that way, even if the doors were so thin you could hear everything through them.
I can totally imagine. Now let's talk about Hilda then, because she grew up in this. How did it affect her?
How did it affect her? Well, she was determined to live a better life. She was determined to live a life with love and decency at the heart of it. And these are not very fashionable terms, but actually that's her great kind of legacy to me, and hopefully to my son as well, that it's actually an honourable thing to live an ordinary, honest life. So she grew up with her father kind of, ducking and diving, you know, stealing things from Kennington Market, drinking away his money, relying on favours, this whole kind of wheedling through life and never really getting very far with it, even though, you'd think that somehow they would. So I think in terms of her and what she was determined to do, she always wanted a family, and she became the matriarch of our family in that way that these kind of, if you look at EastEnders and you look at Lou Beale and, from the old days, that matriarchs kept home and hearth together. They were incredibly strong women in South East and East London. And Hilda was definitely one of them. And that became her kind of life work, in a sense, that she became the centre point, you know, the heart of our family. And that was really what she wanted from life. And I think that's an extraordinary progression from living with the kind of violence that she did, that she didn't in any way perpetuate that, that she stepped away from that life and she really did live a life with dignity. And I think that's extraordinary.
So tell us about her mother, because she was more close. I think it's the most close relationship I've ever read in a book. Mm-hmm. Tell us about their relationship.
Well, it's lovely that you've said that. My nan was her mother's right-hand woman from the age of seven. She would do all of the housework along with her mother, because her mother had an undiagnosed heart complaint, so was very poorly for a lot of the time and also very pregnant for a lot of the time. So my nan would get her younger siblings ready for school. She would, obviously in those days it was back-breaking work, it was scrubbing floors, it was scrubbing clothes, it was hanging things out on damp, dark, dirty washing lines. It was, it was a slog. And Yeah, and you know, my nan was really proud to be her mum's right-hand woman, and she wouldn't have had it any other way. She was incredibly protective of her, and as you'll see in the book, many a time she took a beating or two on behalf of her mother, or would stay up late so that when her father sort of crashed in drunk from a drinking hole, that she would get his dinner ready. And you think, oh my God, you had to be up for school in a few hours, and yet she was there doing that.
So because of this, she didn't really have much fun until she left school, and then the smell of a vanilla in the air.
I disagree, actually. I think my nan always said that they didn't have money, but they lived like kings in Bermondsey, because it was the most exotic playground that you could imagine. There were all these amazing sort of sights and smells. There were the ships coming into harbour. They would stand on Tower Bridge and look over all this excitement, the hustle and bustle, the smells of the vanilla, as you say, from the custard factory, from Peak Freen. I think she had an incredibly exciting childhood outside of the home, you know. And of course, kids ran free in a completely different way than they do these days. I mean, they were sort of wild when they were out of home. And so they all look back, and this is my nan's siblings as well, that they look back with great fondness. And I don't think their hearts ever left Bermondsey and the dockside. Wow. You know, that they called a section of it their beach. And you know, literally, you wouldn't want your child playing on there now. It's, you know, covered in oil and this, that and the other. But to them, it was this kind of magical arena that they were completely free in. But yeah, as she got older, she worked at Peak Freen.
Yeah, tell us biscuit about
factory.
This. Yeah,
yeah. Well, it's such an iconic place. And
what biscuits do they make that we know of?
Garibaldi's.
Yeah.
I believe
they used to call them squash fly, remember?
Oh, did she? Squash fly. Yeah, well, she packed the squash flies, yeah. I think they made custard creams as well, but don't quote me on that. I mean, loads of childhood favourites.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, I mean, they used to supply the soldiers during the Second World War, didn't they? They had the big government contract. And so she was taken on at the age of 14. She loved it. And I think it was the friendship she formed there that enabled her to kind of have her own taste of independence away from, you know, the chores at home, away from being responsible for her siblings, away from the threat of beatings from her father, that finally she could actually, like you say, have a little bit of fun.
Listen to us online, on your phone, download a podcast, or on your tablet. Radio Gorgeous, there for you.
And the thing that did change her life, we don't want to go into too much, we don't want to give too much away, but the thing that changed her life really was the Second World War.
That's right. They almost lost their lives in a huge raid on Spa Road in Bermondsey in May 1941. And it was after that night when the town hall was bombed, which was literally over the road from them. It missed them in their Anderson shelter. After that, they went up to Northampton to be evacuated.
And Northampton sounded blissful compared to a life
before. They moved to Braunston from there, so they had a little bit of a move, they were running free in the fields. Actually got harder for my nan, because she was looking after her mother, who was very ill by then. So, and it was at that point that she met my grandfather.
Exactly. Now, all I can say is that it is a happy ending, which is such a relief, because when you're reading it is traumatic, I even got terribly upset. But you know what I mean? Reading the violence, I found it very difficult, to be honest. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, it kind of should be, shouldn't it?
But I'm really pleased you put it in. In fact, I'm wondering what your reaction has been from, like, women's groups, and, you know, have you given it to kind of people that work in domestic violence or anything?
Well, I've had quite a few comments on Twitter, quite a lot of people getting in contact with me, and overwhelmingly it's been really positive, as in this, you know, I'm glad that this, you've given voice to
to
women of her generation.
Well, if you could go and do talks, you know.
Yeah, that would be great. Because
it'd be fantastic. Because it's not written about, is it?
No, it's not. No. And that's the beauty of doing an oral history. It becomes social history. And it's a huge privilege to give voice to my grandmother's story, but also to give voice to women of her generation who lived in that interwar period, who literally they had nothing, they had no support, they had each other, and that was it. And they kept, you know, they kept our country together, you know, if we're really honest about it, particularly during wartime. And they lived with incredible humour and resilience.
And they had no education.
And they had no education. Well, my nan was at school until she was 14. And it was very much about being smart and polite and clean. You know, that's how it was. And she learnt domestic science. And, you know, at the time she thought, well, what an irony. I've been cooking since I was seven. But, you know, yeah.
Wonderful.
Not much.
Now, you said that she came into your life, I mean, as in you could feel her spiritually. Can you just tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, did you really feel her?
Yeah, I really felt her, yeah. And it was a pleasure, but a strange pleasure. I mean, she died in 2003. And I guess I hadn't realised how much I'd missed her, actually, and how much of an impact her stories had made on me and my life. And it seemed so obvious that these anecdotes and these stories existed, and then and suddenly it was like, well, actually, they need to be shared. But as I wrote, I had pictures of Nan all around me. I mean, obviously, I had her school certificates and various other documents, so, you know, in terms of accuracy. But I really felt her with me, and to the point that I could hear her voice very clearly in my head. And if I, you know, if I sit back and have a think about it, she's there. She was such a kind of, she was such a powerful figure, and she was an extraordinary woman. So she has this amazing presence. And I really felt I was channeling her voice, and I hope that comes across.
We ain't got no drink, Pa.
That's right.
Published by Orion. Thank you so much for coming, Catherine, onto Radio Gorgeous today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Produced and presented by Josephine Pembroke, and beautifully edited by Ella Gray Thomas, 2015.